everyone. Today is March 27th, 2014. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neurobiology Podcast. Our guest today is Todd Roberts. He's an assistant professor of neuroscience and Thomas O. Hicks Scholar in Medical Research at UT Southwestern in Dallas. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
So Todd is using a super modern toolkit for looking at how auditory memories are encoded and guide learning in songbirds. And so it sounds like you just celebrated your first anniversary of your research program. Is that right?
That's right. I just started at UT Southwestern last March, and so it's been 1 year.
Okay, the experience in five words or less.
Slow but great.
Awesome. Okay, so with us today, we've got Todd Troyer, as usual.
Hello.
Hi, Todd. And we've got Todd's grad student, Anand Kulkarni.
Hi.
Okay, cool. Thanks for joining us all. Todd, you've been searching for the auditory representation of the tutor song in songbird vocal learning. And in your hands, the HVC, which is understood as a premotor structure that's essential for song generation, is turning out to be an important locus for encoding the tutor sensory input. So, but before we even talk about your data, but you're shaking your head on it. Did I say something wrong?
No.
Sometimes I do.
I'm just trying to cross. All
right. So before we even talk about your data and its implications, can you first just say something about your technical approaches to this question, because your methods are pretty unique and incredible in the song learning field, from what I understand.
Well,
they're new.
They're new to the song learning field, but they're not new to neuroscience.
Yeah.
So, you know, essentially what I did when I was a postdoc with Rich Mooney at Duke was adapt or, you know, just take some of the methods that had been developed in mice for tackling, you know, in certain ways similar problems, including in vivo two-photon imaging methods where you can track changes to structural dynamics or synapses in the brain, optogenetic methods, and some more recent genetic lesioning methods, just taking these tools that people have used in mice and adapted them so that they work well in birds. And it's, you know, the real benefit has been in allowing us to have greater and greater spatial and temporal resolution to ask questions about learning and memory that the field really didn't have before.
So in some ways, I would phrase it in some ways the other way, I guess, touting the songbird field. In some ways, what you've done is bring the songbird behavioral power toolbox to those methods, right? So you have the great thing about the songbirds is you have such amazing specificity in the behavior. So when you intervene, when, either what time of learning with what kind of behavioral kind of thing, or what specific aspects of inside this temporal behavior that you do. So if you have those tools with the great specificity and the ability to look at fine details and track it over time, you bring the songbird behavioral toolbox to those methods. And in some ways, I think that's what kind of jacks things up. I mean, would you agree?
Well, I guess I agree to a certain extent. I just don't want people to have the impression that these are tools that, you know, that I developed, because certainly I didn't. You know, I've just used tools that others have developed in you know, a way that is unique. You know, for example, I think, you know, one of the things that's very unique about what Rich and I did was, you know, take optogenetic methods and tie them into this really precise behavior that songbirds use particularly, what we are looking at is how a young bird memorizes the song of its tutor. And they do this during social interactions with the tutor. And these are, the tutor sings his song and the pupil memorizes it during these brief social encounters. And the song itself is incredibly precise. It only lasts a few hundred milliseconds. And what we did was, you know, take advantage of this and couple the singing of the tutor and use that to drive optogenetic stimulation in pupil's brain. And so basically we designed an experiment so that we can harness the
temporal precision of optogenetic methods and marry that to the temporal precision of the behavior that the birds naturally do and design these closed-loop experiments where a tutor controls the optogenetic stimulation in the pupil's brain. And you know, by doing this, we are able to dissect out circuits in the brain that tend to seem to play a critical role in learning and memory.
So I'm kind of just interested in this idea of so HPC is considered to be sort of kind of at the top of the motor part of it. It's a sensory motor structure. So could you just I guess we will hopefully get into some details about your actual evidence that HPC is the site of these representations, but could you just say something about the impact of this idea on the general principles of where we understand sensory representations falling on the continuum between sensory and motor input output, you know, that dichotomy that's sort of set up, and how people have thought about this in the song literature, and sort of why your findings sort of different, or is it different?
Well, there's been debate in the songbird field for quite a while on where memories of the tutor song are represented in the brain. And people have looked in motor structures and they've looked in auditory structures. And over the last 15 years or so, the debate had shifted very heavily to memories being encoded in auditory regions that are presynaptic to motor structures. And so, historically, the songbird system, the neural system that is necessary for learning and producing song, has been thought of as a hierarchical system. So, in certain ways, a feed-forward system where there's auditory circuits that are presynaptic to the motor circuits, and then there's a series of motor circuits that are necessary for producing learned aspects of behavior and driving variability in the behavior. And these two circuits have been thought of as somewhat separate things with only, information going in one way. You know, auditory information flows into the motor circuits and then motor output comes out. And there isn't much crosstalk between the two. And previous researchers have identified was that there are tutor selective responses in the auditory region, and there is immediate early gene activation or expression of immediate early genes in regions of the auditory system when you play back tutor song, and certain areas of the auditory forebrain, if activity in those regions are disrupted, that it can disrupt learning of the tutor song. And there's been a whole series of experiments that have all pointed towards auditory regions playing an important role in encoding tutor song. But what we were interested in doing was actually looking downstream of those regions in the motor circuitry. And one of the reasons was that a previous postdoc in Rich Mooney's lab, John Prather, had identified mirror neurons in HVC. These are neurons that respond when the bird is singing its song and also respond in a similar fashion when the bird is listening to the song. And I was curious of whether or not these sensory responses might be come about early in development, when the bird's first listening to a tutor song, rather than developing slowly during sensory motor learning as the bird practices its song. Birds will practice their song over 100,000 times during development as they're trying to get a good copy of it. So that's where we jumped off from, is that finding, and then looking in HVC to see if sensory experience of the tutor actually drove plastic changes in this network. Once we saw that, then we started doing functional manipulations to see if this network seemed to be necessary for song learning. And just to give you the full range, what we found was that it does seem to be necessary. I can go into this in more detail, but it seems that basically, any manipulation that we do that disrupts activity in HVC when a bird is being tutored is sufficient to block the bird's ability to learn from the Tudor song. And now the real question is whether or not, you know, these circuits are talking back to the auditory system, or, you know, what, you know, how does this all come back together, you know? And so I think the debate is still open because we don't really know yet, you know, the full architecture of how sensory and motor systems are talking to each other. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, for example, you know, all of the evidence that we have to date suggests that HVC plays a critical role in learning from the tutoring experience. But it doesn't tell us that areas downstream of HVC aren't involved. It could be that information is being relayed through HVC to downstream structures. And so there's still a lot of work to do.
So one word that Salma used that's interesting that your experiments really don't get at, and that's the question of representation, right? So you get, and that starts to be where the language of sensory motor representation start to really get, and you separate things off, and then you really start to have to confuse about what's really going on. You're talking about whether this is necessary for learning the behavior in this sensory mode. And you don't know, is it a throughput for a representation? Is,
right.
it, like, is it setting the groundwork? Is it setting an ability to interface? Or is it actual representation of the thing itself? And I don't know. It goes back and forth because it's almost hard to think about the problem if it's not thinking about representation, whatever you think that is in the brain. But when you do, then you have these weird – then you have to decide which is motor and which is sensory, and that the sensory representation of the bird's own song gets copied to the sensory memory that changes the motor representation. And then you have to segment things.
Right.
It's possible that it's not – there's all mishmash, you know, it's all happening everywhere. It's, you know, feedback or what, or not, you know. And so it's, like God said, the questions are still open about separating those kinds of things. But it's not the case that the, I mean, your experiment showed it's not the case that the sensory representation happens in some sensory areas, and that's independent, and then something else, the interface with the motor, happens when the bird is only singing.
Right. I think you know, what our evidence argues against is this traditional view that is actually a very logical way of thinking about it, that what the bird does first is form an auditory memory, and then as it practices its song, it slowly maps that auditory experience into a motor framework that the bird uses to produce its behavior. And our experiments argue against that model. You know, and I have to say that you know, that model falls naturally out of the behavior that we observe in birds. You know, so a bird first listens to a tutor song, and it can hold on to these memories for long periods of time without ever practicing their song. And then once they start to practice, they then slowly develop the ability to imitate the tutor song. And, you know, and so it kind of makes sense if you just think about neural circuits that, you know, maybe it would start off as just an auditory experience, a sensory experience, and a sensory memory that's slowly mapped into motor coordinates. But, you know, what our experiments argue is that, you know, perhaps this sensory experience is directly mapped into a motor coordinate framework or a more complicated sensory motor framework. And understanding that representation is going to be a challenge. It's going to take a lot of work. And as you indicate, you know, particularly once you get into a sensory motor area in the brain that, you know, is necessary for producing a learned behavior, but it also is the interface to a sensory circuit. You know, how to dissect these things out when they're so intricately intertwined is very, very difficult.
So, you know, in terms of the visual system, which I guess everyone has to talk about when you're talking about any kind of sensory anything, right? The coordinate frames are easy to sort of imagine. You know, we understand the coordinate transformation. What are the coordinate frames that we're thinking about in auditory systems and in vocal systems? I mean, can you talk about how that idea translates? Because the sort of XY framework and the 3D, you know, motor framework from the retina to motor output makes sense to me intuitively, right?
Right, right. No, it's challenging, right? And I think we're still trying to grapple with that question in the field. you know, one thing that in the field we're pretty certain we know, and this has, you know, been borne out through studies from lots of lab, including Michael Fee's lab and Dan Robovich's lab, is that HVC plays a critical role in the temporal organization of the bird's behavior. And this is, you know, through, you know, studies of, you know, electrophysiological recordings from singing birds, of heating and cooling the nucleus, where you can get, you know, temporal expansion or contraction of the song depending on the temperature of the nucleus. And so we know that HVC, or at least we think we know that HVC, is playing a critical role in the temporal organization of the behavior. Whether it's playing a role in the spectral organization of the behavior is there's a potential there too, but we know less about it so far. But right, so the bird, what it has to do, the challenge that it has is, you know, a song framework would encompass, you know, frequency modulation, amplitude modulation, you know, the pitch of individual elements, where it starts and stops these individual elements, you know, and so it's a really higher order type of representation, you know, where you're combining lots of different parameters.
So are you going to be able to, do you think that optogenetic tools are going to be the right way to resolve some of that? Because, I mean, you showed us some remarkable data about how simulating in HVC at temporal interval can actually change the structure, the actual spectral structure of the song. Is that right? Did I understand that right? Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Right. Well, what we've seen in some of our preliminary studies is that when a bird is listening to the tutor song, if we stimulate into the circuitry that's projecting into HVC, into the auditory inputs, this auditory pathway that comes into HVC, that, and again, we're only stimulating when the bird is listening to the tune, and then we raise the birds up in isolation to adulthood and see how much they've learned from this tutoring experience, is that we can block their ability to learn the tutor song. But on top of that, what we see is that the birds have a tendency to emulate the frequency patterns of how we were stimulating in the brain. So they will sing song elements that are repeated at intervals that map onto our stimulation parameters, you know, suggesting that perhaps we're tapping into a circuit that's doing online encoding of temporal features of the tutor song.
I think that there's another thing that's interesting in terms of that maybe down the line that we'll have Michael Brainerd, and we're starting to do it too, and lots of other people in the field are doing that, that you've done with the tutor song, right? So you've done things like have the birds change their song as an adult by triggering aversive stimuli to very specific features of what's happening. So you say target a given syllable, the pitch is too high, you play a noise, and the bird moves its song to avoid that. Well, you could pair something like that, whatever the stimulation is, and you could say, if you think that it's aversive or rewarding, you could, instead of doing an aversive stimulus like a noise burst, you could say stimulate VTA or get into the circuits that you think are either aversive or rewarding. And you can perturb things that are very specific. So you could trigger based on that triggering. You could do some optogenetic stimulation in some particular area that you feel that is important, and then it's encoding this feature versus that feature, and only perturb, you know, trigger based on one feature or the other. And you could start to figure this out, because you can target disruptions. It's harder with kind of active, you know, implanting a frequency in the brain or some kind of memory is a lot harder. But if you can target certain disruptions of specific features to specific areas under specific circumstances, and do it in a kind of a closed loop way where the bird is under control of that, And I think the possibilities for picking apart some of these things, you know, are really pretty promising.
I think the tool set, you know, has, you know, people have put a lot of work and effort in the Songbird field of developing the tools for doing this. Just recently people have published, Ben Solvesky's group at Harvard has published a very nice paper where they're showing that they can dissect out, you know, circuitry in the brain that's important for shaping temporal components using these reinforcement methods that Todd is talking about versus circuits that are important for spectral components of the bird's song. And so, you know, marrying that with optogenetic methods or you know, more circuit-specific types of techniques. I think one of the challenges that we have in our field, though, because we don't have the arsenal of genetic tools available to us, is really going to be getting to the cell-specific techniques, you know, where you're not just optogenetically activating or silencing a population of cells, with incredible temporal specificity, but still, you know, without cellular specificity or without synaptic specificity. And I think that's going to be the next, you know, hurdle that the field needs to get over, you know, so that we can really start, dissecting out these complicated circuits in a more meaningful way.
So do you have an update? I mean, I don't keep up with that stuff about how are things going. I mean, the zebrafish genome has been sequenced and all this stuff, and people are working on transferring more and more of those tools over to this song system. Do you have any sense of how that's going?
I don't know. I don't have a sense. I know that more and more people are trying to do transgenics now, and it seems to be successful. But so far, at least in the published work, it's still based on using lentiviruses to make transgenic animals. And you know, as you can imagine. So this is taking a lentivirus, injected it into making a window in the egg right after the egg is laid, and using that to generate transgenic birds. You know, there are many problems with this technology, of course, right? You have limited packaging capacity in these type of viruses. You're not targeting specific regions of the DNA. You're not inserting it in certain regions, you know, so you can't readily do knockouts or knock-ins in any meaningful way. You also can't control copy number in the DNA, and so leading to genetic problems in terms of, you know, sustaining these transgenic lines. Right now, the way that I and others have been working on addressing these methods is using cocktails or different types of viruses with different serotypes, and using the circuit anatomy to get at it. And so there are, you can use AAVs, for example, with different serotypes, and the different serotypes, some will only infect locally in a region while others will express retrogradely. You can use that in combination with Cre recombinase and Cre dependent viruses or transgenes, and be able to then get cell-specific expression in projection neurons, for example, retrogradely expressing Cre in one population, and getting them to express a gene of interest. But that will get us part of the way there, but it's not going to get us the whole way there. Perhaps if there are enough groups that are working on these new transgenic methods, CRISPR and Talents, in trying to generate perhaps, backbone transgenic animals that will make the development of future transgenics faster and easier. We can get there quickly.
Is that imminent? What's the word on the street?
Yeah.
You're the guy, right? Who sort of would know.
I haven't really dabbled in transgenics myself. So
you're the potential market.
Yeah, exactly.
I am the potential market for those, but Carlos Lewis would probably know the best. You know, I think he's done the most work. He's published the first transgenic songbird work. There's been some recent abstracts at SFN, talking about the next generation of transgenics, but I am unaware of any major breakthrough, but that doesn't mean anything. there could be.
Yeah, you're a beginning assistant professor. Right, like, exactly. Sit in your lab and there are other things.
Yeah, there might be four Nature papers in queue to come out next week, and I want to know.
Right. I'll be aware.
I think the community would benefit from a more concerted and unified effort to try to tackle these issues. As far as I know, it's pretty dispersed right now. People are working on this in isolation. But, for us to make real progress, it's going to take several labs working, on not in competition, but in unity, trying to move the transgenics forward.
Historically, the Songbird community has been pretty tight, right? I mean, it's a good group of people who have... I mean, there's not a lot of adversarial stuff going on, right? I know you don't want to say this on the record, but it seems like that from the outside, is that the people we've had come through are all super collaborative, and, we can let that fall flat. That's okay.
No, I think the answer is yes and no, but it's as good or better than some other fields. It's worse, I think. It's more competitive and more fractured than maybe some other fields. But I would say that that's a reasonable impression.
And of course, part of the unity comes from the fact that I think the questions that we're asking in the Songbird field are all, I think everyone's on the same page on what's important, right? We all have similar goals and similar types of questions that we're trying to answer.
Yeah, I mean,
so the field does seem to move forward.
Yeah, I say that because there is this, we've had people here, we've had Allison Duke here, we've had Eric Jarvis here, and they've talked about this wanting to pull together the avian brain nomenclature form,
right.
Just this sort of needing to, understanding that you sort of need to pull together to build a real database of how to understand this system. So that's what came to mind, and that's, yes, no one should ever go on record saying that their field is contentious or not. Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question regarding the experiments that you published about the stabilization of the spines in the HPC post cutting experience for a juvenile. So, and that sort of suggests some kind of a stabilization of, that's a cessation of plasticity to whatever extent it does. So, in that technique, is there any way to sort of tease apart HVC's synapses versus, let's say, AV or NIF HVC synapses? Now, so is it possible that the synapses that come from the auditory system really stabilize, but the plasticity in the HVC synapses goes on until you crystallize your song?
No, that's a great question. It's an important issue, and right now we don't have a great method for doing this. It's very difficult to know who the presynaptic partner is for these dendritic spines. So
can we just back up for 1 second? Just hold your thought. So this is the idea. I don't know if the listeners got it from the question, but so you've shown that you've actually correlated synaptic structure in vivo with the quality of behavioral learning following post tutor song exposure, right? So you correlated spine number and size with song crystallization.
With learning of from the sensory experience of the tutor. So what we did was use leniviruses to express EGFP in neurons in HVC in young birds that were raised in isolation from a tutor song. And then we went in and did longitudinal two-photon imaging of these neurons and tracked changes to dendritic spines in HVC in birds before they had tutor experience and then following tutoring experience. And what we saw was a couple of things. First, we saw that that birds prior to tutoring start off with high levels of spine turnover, suggesting a more dynamic synaptic network, and that following tutoring in the birds that subsequently learn from the tutoring experience that the level of spine turnover, this is the average of the gain and lost spines, that this decreases sharply. In conjunction with that, we saw that the population of stable dendritic spines gets larger, that not in number, but I mean in volume. So an individual dendritic spun that is there before the bird has a tutoring experience and still there after the bird has a tutoring experience, that the spine head gets bigger, they enlarge. This is correlated with increases in the number of AMPA receptors in the spine head and with synaptic strength. But you know, the question is, do we know who these spines are? You know, who are their presynaptic partners? Are they are we looking at a network of spines that are receiving local inputs from other HVC neurons, or are we looking at spines that are receiving extrinsic inputs from auditory areas in the brain? You know, the basic answer is that we don't know, but we have some pieces of evidence that indicate that, you know, at least a portion of these spines that we're looking at are associated with receiving input from auditory regions in the brain. And we know that because we've also done electrophysiological experiments. We've done sharp intracellular recordings in HVC in vivo before and after the birds have been tutored. And what we see is an increase in the amplitude of depolarizing postsynaptic potentials immediately following tutoring experience, and we see an increase in bursting activity in these neurons. And we know that bursting activity in HVC is driven from an auditory input to HVC, an area called NIF. And so when we take all of these pieces of evidence together, it suggests that at least one thing that's likely happening when the bird gets tutored is that the synapses between NIF and HVC are getting stronger.
Thanks for bringing that up. Well, thank you for being here. We're kind of out of time. This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop with Todd Roberts. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.